And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning. 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 5th of May, 2023. How are you doing? I do hope you're very well indeed, and hopefully you're along for the ride for the next 3 hours here on the 9 to noon show. We have our Friday panel joining us very shortly, but we want you involved in the conversation as well as we run through our various topics. If you want to WhatsApp or text 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000. If you prefer to call, we've got Niamh and Donna Marie taking your calls on 074 91 25000, and you can also email comments at highlandradio.com, and feel free to join us and watch the programme across our YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch on your Fire Stick or your Smart TV, or across our Facebook pages as well, and indeed on our website. Okay, so without further ado, let's say good morning to Emer McGuinness, manager of the Donegal Mart. Good morning to you, Emer.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back on the show. Thanks for accepting the invite. Professor Pat O'Connor is a professor of sociology, social policy at Limerick University. Pat, always a pleasure to have you on the show as well. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you for having me.
And our final guest, Cathair Loch, Liam Blaney. Good morning to you, Liam. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg.
It's great to have you with us. Okay. Much conversation this week in certain areas about new laws that are aimed at curbing hate speech. They've sparked controversy in Ireland and abroad. The updated legislation will create landmark laws to deal with hate crimes, making an offence to deny or trivialise genocide, and expand protection to include gender identity and disability. Opponents of the Criminal Justice Bill have raised concerns the changes go too far and will stifle free speech. However, their defenders say Ireland's current legislation has been outstripped by the internet and contains significant blind spots. Existing hate speech laws date back to 1989 with the provision prohibition of Incite to Hatred Act. This makes it an offence to communicate threatening, abusive or insulting material that's likely to stir up hatred against a group of people. However, under this new law, a person can defend themselves against charges by proving they did not intend to spread hatred, and the onus can be on the person with hateful material, let me put it like that, on their devices, for an example, to have to prove that they didn't have an intention to use it for hate. Right. It passed through the Dáil. I think there was only 14, 15 opponents to it. I'll go to you, if that's all right, Professor Pat O'Connor, first. It hasn't, I mean, this is perhaps reasonably significant, or maybe it's not. Maybe the significance of it is being amplified by some sections. I don't know. What's your views on it?
I think partly there's been less comment because it's taken so long. It's basically been on the go since 2021. And I think currently, like, new topics are welcome and discussed, but the public has very little interest in things that have been going on for years. I think this is important piece of legislation, and it's difficult to know, will it work? And in a way, we'll only see that when it's enacted. I suppose what strikes me often is the people who are most vociferous about rights to free speech are the people who seem to have least awareness of the balance between free speech and kind of a social contract, whereby you tolerate and accept the importance of discussion, but don't really personally attack people who have certain views, or for example, people... in the context of women, some people, a minority, I hope, do not accept that women should have a voice in the public arena. And hence, they are determined to silence them in those arenas. And obviously, in the name of free speech sometimes. And obviously, I don't think that's a good thing. I did like Helen McEntee, in defending this bill, stress the importance of recognising that often these claims to free speech were about legitimating the desire to create fear in people and to silence them. And that cannot be tolerated. There is, of course, a balance between free speech and the protection of people who are seen as in some way different, whether in terms of gender or ethnicity or whatever. But personally, I think this is important, but an important piece of legislation. But the question is, will it be implemented and will it work? We tend to be great at passing laws, but not so good at implementing them.
Emer, some people feel that, you know, it might stifle debate, or if you have issues with things and you express those concerns. And, you know, say, for instance, people believe that the issue of transgenderism, for an example, that you couldn't oppose certain changes in laws or what might be spoken in schools or something like that there, for fear that you could be dragged up under these really strong laws as being sort of anti-trans or something. That seems to be much of the concern that's out there. That's only one example of a topic, for example.
I think a lot of the concern would be, you know, what is hate? The definition of hate hasn't been defined properly within the legislation. And I think what a lot of the people that would have went against this from Through the Dáil would feel that before it goes through, they didn't disagree with it passing through the Dáil. What they disagreed with was that hate was not defined. I suppose a lot of it, and I was trying to think, why did it pass so freely through the Dáil? A lot of our politicians, for example, they get an awful lot of hate and a lot of things said about them online, which is, you know, and would you call that freedom of speech or would you call that keyboard warriors venting their frustration with them? And is it nice? No. Is it acceptable? No. But that line, where's that fine line where someone is allowed to say what they think, is allowed to get angry with a politician? I'm just using politicians as an example. Because they do get a lot of it. You know, I do think they need to go back and look at it, and I think that should be fought hard on to amend certain areas of it. No, people should not be allowed to say it's
But victims of hate crime are targeted to prejudice against their age, their ability, ethnicity, religion, nationality, sexual orientation or gender. So that would mean effectively you could criticise, say, for instance, Leo Varadkar based on what he does, his policies, whether you agree or disagree, but you couldn't do it at the same time as using a racial or an homophobic slur, for an example.
Well, you see, again, that is why I think this is at the forefront and passed through so readily, through the Dáil. And for all them reasons that you've just stated, I don't think people should comment on anybody else. Everybody should be allowed to live as they want. But that also, where does freedom of speech come into play? You know, are we going to completely back up the court system? Like, this will be taken to the letter of the law in some areas and with some guards. And if there's a report made to the guards, they will have to follow suit on this. And we have a court system that's backed up with so many different... the court system's completely jammed up. And now we're just going to... It makes it easier to get prosecutions. That's what happens now. I do believe anybody that towards violence or all them things, we should have a law for that. And the law needs to be updated for that. But I think we've gone a little bit too far on this one.
Yeah. What do you think, Liam... because there is the fear there that these changes could lead to simply politically incorrect views being censored. And I mentioned issues around trans rights because that's very big at the moment. But also the laws would make it much easier to secure a conviction for hate crimes. I think that's generally accepted. And does that mean then that people who are opposed to immigration, that if they were to protest that, that that could be deemed to be anti a particular group, for an example? You know, that's what I think people are afraid of, that this will actually, even if it doesn't directly, you know, if people do it, it'll discourage it, I think. I think people feel that this is a way of, you know, dampening down public discourse.
Well, I do believe that something had to be done with it. Have it gone too far? The as you said earlier, there the regulations and the laws that's there present as outdated because of the internet. And you know, you say it's easier to get convictions. It's not that easy to get a conviction in court. You have to prove without doubt. And a lot of people go to court. A lot of cases taken to court thinking they have it proven, and it's a simple matter, but. You know, it's not that easy to get a conviction. You have to be 100% proven that the person meant what they said and understood what they said. And I don't think it's going to be that easy to convict somebody because of something they say, because their opinion of what they said and your opinion and my opinion could be three different opinions of it. And they mightn't might have said something not intended the way some people would take it, they take it out of context. So it's hard to know whether it's gone too far or whether it's gone far enough. But I do believe something definitely had it done. And that's very welcome that that's been tackled. And only time will tell whether they have gone too far with it or not.
Yeah, but Pat, how do we sort of keep checks and balances on this through this process then? Because it did kind of just not come out of the blue. Obviously, it's been a long time and it's working, but it did just, you know, it's through the door, voted on, and now we're talking about it. You know what I mean? At what point in a process like this is there a public input to it? I mean, in fairness, there was a public consultation. The majority of people did believe that these laws go too far. The government, in formulating it, did disregard that. And I think I heard comments from Leo Varadkar yesterday suggesting that, you know, sometimes these public consultation processes can be hijacked by certain groups with an agenda, and that also government really don't have to listen to them. So what is the point then of these public consultation periods? Like, do we need to roll back on this a bit, Pat, do you think?
Well, I mean, I suppose not. I think we shouldn't roll back for the moment. There has been a kind of a crudification of the public discourse over the past 20 years. The legislation that was passed in 1989 has had only 50 prosecutions in 30 years, right? We all know the kind of hate speech. And while people were talking, I looked up what hate speech was, and I thought to myself, well, what exactly is hate speech? And it's speech which is basically speech or writing which expresses prejudice on the basis of whether it's ethnicity, religion, etc. So the example you gave yourself, that in a way one can disagree violently with Leo Varadkar's policies or opinions, but saying it's because he is of a particular descent or because he's homosexual or whatever, that is unacceptable. And really, we need to call it out, because it seems at the minute, I agree with both Liam and Emer on this, anything, it seems at the minute, can be said, and particularly on the internet where people are anonymous often, there is no feeling of taking responsibility for your words, for your actions. And really, like, that is not acceptable. It's sort of, I suppose I think of it, it's like in the playground, picking on people, bullying, right? Somebody smaller or, you know, different from you. And that kind of attitude has to be rooted out. Now, of course, there'll always be, you know, how do you really, you know, get the balance right? But we know the balance isn't right. We know the last legislation, 1989, my God, it's another world. We know there've been very few, as I say, over 30 years, there's been about one prosecution a year. So really something needs to be done. And if in a way this will be monitored and we can tweak it, but there needs to be, we're increasingly diverse society. I mean, there was an item just this morning talking about travellers. You know, we know that racism and misogyny.
Well, you see, it's interesting. The case you talk of is Senator Eileen Flynn, who'll be talking to us a little later on. And she was recounting her experience whereby a taxi driver wouldn't drop her off at a halting site. Now, in speaking out, it opened the floodgates on social media for offensive language.
Exactly. But in a way, like,
so why would you speak out? Because it just seemed to be open season on her then, and the travelling community.
Yes. Well, in a way, like, that is just a nice, well, not a nice.
I understand what you're saying. A perfect timed example.
A perfect timing example of how this, I think of it as a crudification of social discourse has happened. You know, there was a time when before the internet, you'd be writing to the Times or the Examiner or the Press, and that would be some sort of a mechanism to screen out opinions. Now, anybody can become a keyboard warrior and basically say anything with no compunction. And really, we need to have a society where people are able to call things out, people are able to speak. We've seen loads of examples of how whistleblowers have been really, have had a dreadful experience. You think of the Women of Honour and all that has happened in the Defence Forces, that in a way, certain things are not acceptable. Mm-hmm. society. We have to rub along with each other, one way or the other. And in a way, we don't have to love each other. We don't have to, you know, accept the existing policies or the political decisions. But we do have to frame our critique in a way which recognizes that there's a thing called a society, you know, and you can't. I mean, we also have seen with
Trump. But we also have seen, but what we have seen recently, though, and any of you can come in on this, of course, as well, is what we have seen is some language used in the Dáil, right? That would be classed as conspiracy theory language, and I'm referring to Micheál Martin's comments on the ditch, for an example, right? Okay, so things can, you know, language can be used in a very, very powerful way. And it can be used, and especially when you enjoy parliamentary privilege. So you've got the people that are happy to use parliamentary privilege to get their point across and come out with stuff that's, you know, disprovable. But at the same time, the general population introducing laws to effectively that if they took a notion could stop conversations on an awful lot of things. Is that one of your concerns, Emer?
It would be. I suppose I was thinking last night when I was looking at it, what's going to happen to the Piers Morgan programme, because he has plenty to say on everything. As I said, something has to be done, and certainly bring the law in. But I do think amendments does have to be made for it, because people should not be fearful of speaking out and saying what they think. Education, monitoring the internet, there's certain things should be done. And I suppose there should be, if somebody makes a statement, there should be monitoring of that to see what people say. And, you know, and that's the way it'll have to be tackled. Unfortunately, we can't gag everyone. People, certain elements of people will still, I have to say, I'd be very, go in there. And I'd always, if it was something I disagreed with strongly, I would respond to it too. So I'm probably one of those people. I'd like to think it wouldn't be derogatory to anybody.
Well, you see that, Sid, or hurting intentionally yeah. Targeting people with a prejudice based on their age, ability. I mean, some of the language, right? I mean, I think we can have the conversation about, say, the transgender issues, but some of the language that's being used. Now, there are people listening to this program who are trans, or their children are, or what have you. Some of the language in that, like, we could still have that conversation. But it, some of the language is very, very offensive to people.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I do believe that if somebody opens a discussion and certainly opens it up to the public, that conversation then should be monitored and everything in it and everybody that responds to it. But taking it to a case of basically bringing in a legislation that stops people having an open debate, it's like something in the agricultural sector, and you know, there's a statement released and I have my opinion on it that might differ to the person who has released it. I should be allowed to respond to that. I shouldn't be afraid to respond to that. But should I be allowed to abuse them? Absolutely not. And that should be monitored.
I think, Liam, as well, this is a fine example that we see time and time again in that, you know, I think it'd be far better if these things were explained in greater detail, that there was some sort of a platform whereby, and I know there was a public consultation, I'm not on about that, but whereby things were explained in a little bit more detail, not something passed through the Dáil and then you sort of have to address each point as it's raised. You know, better communication on this, Liam, I think would help people form opinions better. We're not great at communicating in this country, I don't think, sometimes.
Well, I'm not so sure of that, Greg.
Okay.
Because I'm not up to date, to be honest with you, with the different stages that it has gone through. But I do know one, as Emer has said there, just because you don't agree with somebody's opinion doesn't mean you have to use some of the language that is used. And name calling, like the way some of them do, you know, things to get. And I think that, like, that has to be stopped. Mm-hmm. How do you stop it? No matter what way you try to stop it, there's people going to be annoyed with it. Nothing that's going to say is not correct. And as Professor said there earlier, make a start on it. It can be changed. But I think we do definitely have to make an effort at it.
Yeah.
And that has been done at the moment.
And just before we move on, back to you, Pat, there's a text in here that's kind of interesting, because it says, all we have to do is look at the story of J.K. Rowling. All she did was defend women and is being accused of being transphobic. These hate laws would not stop J.K. Rowling with the arguments that she's made. Her arguments, well, if you don't, I mean, obviously, if you're on the receiving end of them, you might find them upsetting, but she doesn't use offensive language. She makes arguments that would not fall under this hate speech law. But then at the same time, they also say there'll be drag queens in every national school in the country and we won't be able to say anything, which is kind of conflating two different things, really, there. I think that's where the fear has been whipped up right across this nation.
Well, I mean, it's paradoxical that the writer sounds as if they're defending a trial by social media while at the same time criticising the legislative attempts to control it. You know, I suppose I want to come back to Micheál Martin and the Dáil, his attack in the ditch. I thought that was completely out of order, completely unacceptable. And it was interesting, the ombudsman was on and basically said they were surprised that if somebody had an issue with the ditch, it wasn't reported to the press ombudsman, who could decide as to whether or not there was a case. That would have been the proper forum. I mean, I appreciate that we all lose the rag sometimes and people say things, you know, that they'd be better off keeping their mouth shut. But it is important, I suppose, to name things, you know, and to recognise when people are out of order, just as we should recognise it in ourselves.
Well, Liam, do you think the Taoiseach was justified, the Tarnisher, sorry, is now, was justified in his... I didn't hear what you said. I was correcting myself. Sorry, Pat. But, you know, like, I suppose from his perspective, he and his party has been getting an awful lot of coverage, and it was his opportunity to fire one across the bows. No pun intended, actually, given the who helped create the ditch. Liam, did you back him in what he said?
I don't know. Does he have more information than what he's saying? As someone in his position to say what he said, I think has more information than what we realise. I could be wrong on that. But to make a statement like that, even was under the privilege of the Dáil, I think you need to have quite a bit of proof. And I do believe that there's more to it than what he exactly said, or he knows there's more to it. That's my own opinion on it. I could be wrong on that. But, you know, when you have a particular media outlet attacking a particular party or two all the time, you just wonder, do they have a specific agenda against that party, or the setup for that particular reason? I'm not sure.
Okay, that's the voice there of Liam Blaney. And we also have Professor Pat O'Connor and Emer McGuinness with us. Some of your comments coming in here. Greg, there's a very simple philosophy re hate speech. Don't say or do anything to or about anyone that you wouldn't like to be done or said about yourself. That comes in from Mary. Now, my experience online, and I'm never offline, if the truth be told, is I don't really ever see what anything I would define as hate speech, except from anonymous accounts on Twitter. That's pretty much the only place I've seen stuff that would fall into those categories. A caller says the greatest levels of hate speech seem to be directed towards Christianity and others whose beliefs don't fit in with today's neo-pagan secular agenda. Another, the legislation has gone too far. We need to stand up and object to this before we are unable to say a word about anything that is said in our schools. Another caller believes just another means of controlling everyone, especially anyone who opposes government policies and keep the power out of citizens' hands. Ignoring the outcomes of public consultations is proof of an agenda to me. What is the role of public consultations, Liam? Because we would have them on various topics. They're there to gauge public opinion. But like, say, for instance, a good example, and I don't mean this controversial, but a typical example might be, say, for instance, a variation of the property tax. I presume through the public consultation, loads of people don't say, right, keep it the same or raise it. They might say cut it. But at the end of the day, it's an executive decision to raise it. Issues like that. So public consultations in sort of the political sphere, they do have an influence, but they don't determine policy either, do they? It's just still muted there, Liam. Sorry.
Sorry, Greg.
It's all right.
They don't particularly determine policy, but they do give the people that has the role of changing policy an idea of what people think. But as far as I see, and Donegal and Donegal County Council, there's very little people get involved in public consultations. They don't seem to bother. But there is at times an effort made by a group with a particular agenda. We'll make an effort and look for people to go out and do a petition. And if somebody comes to you, do you know when they ask you to sign a petition? There's not too many of them say no. And then you have a public consultation that's leaning one way. Not all the people that signed it feel the same thing, but they feel hard to say no when it's put in front of them. And, you know, those making the policy changes has to take that into consideration and has to take, I suppose, their own discussions with their own supporters into consideration as well. And at the end of the day, as far as the politics and then the council is concerned, it's the public representatives make the decision.
Just before we move on this one, Emer, are you disappointed maybe that the opposition didn't, in whichever form that might be, by the way, I'm not talking about one particular party, did not sort of maybe try and draw this debate out a little bit more?
Well, as I said from the start, I do believe they didn't, because every one of them probably suffer at the hands of it every day. So that is why they quite happily let it pass through and did believe, and rightly so, that something had to change. But this broad view of bringing in this legislation to tackle an issue, it covers so many parts, as freedom of speech and people now being afraid to say what they think. People have been afraid to open up discussions. I think that we have gone far too far. And while people needed to be protected, I do believe if you open up a discussion like Micheál Martin and the dog, you have to be prepared. He should have been prepared beforehand. He knew exactly what he was going to say and he went ahead and said it. So he is responsible. So anybody that opens up a discussion or a debate has to be prepared to answer on that, whether it's positive or negative. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that is why you see a lot of our politicians getting attacked, that they have to stand accountable for all these different legislations that come, whether we like them or not. And I am disappointed that more has, but I would like to think that all these, I suppose this news programme, there's loads of them probably going on. I know it was on the Tonight Show last night, that there will be amendments made to it and there will be changes made to it. I believe there should be and there has to be. People should be allowed to speak in a proper manner, obviously, on different topics.
Yeah, indeed. And I think the government should make proper efforts to explain this, to let people understand what's going on and what the process is, rather than sound bites or short interviews. I think there's more of a responsibility because I think it's never been more important that, yes, listen to programmes like this. Yes, go on to websites or other platforms. Yeah. But people need to get to the... I think the public need to and should have learned, we should all have learned at this point, that you have to go to the source of the information as well, and not necessarily someone's interpretation or you know, not with their political slant on it. Pat, would you agree that we really need to, you know, rather than if I only consume sort of right-leaning or left-leaning media, for an example, I'm only going to sort of get one side of that story or one interpretation of it. I think it's on us to make sure that we go to the source material and have a look at of ourselves too, and listen to different types of media and try and formulate our opinions like that, Pat.
Absolutely. I suppose to come back to your question on to Liam on consultations, public consultations, like in a way, I do sometimes think that they're simply an attempt to kick the can down the road, do you know? That they're simply an attempt to find cover politically. So in a way, if the result comes out that it suits the tenor of the times, then they'll be accepted. But I have been a bit irritated, for example, at the number of citizens' assemblies that are being created. Like, these are a very good idea, but the idea you have one and then you implement the recommendations before you go on to the next and the next and the next. It's a bit now like, you know, it's becoming, we're trivializing these attempts. And I suppose it raises the question, you know, are the concept of Chacta Dála, messengers of the people, are they messengers of the people or not, you know? If we need endless paid consultants, citizens' assemblies, et cetera, well, you know, do we need the number of TDs we have and local government officials?
Well, more are coming, so...
Exactly. Exactly. Now, so in a way, of course, to come to your point, I mean, Emer's point, I completely agree that this, you know, it can, there is the possibility that people will feel silenced, and that is wrong. So in essence, it is a balance. I wouldn't disagree with Emer on an awful lot of what she said, but I do think that things have reached such a pitch that things have to be done.
Right. Okay. Emer, just a quick one from you and then around the table, so to speak. We are entering what's been sort of framed as a milk war, butter war. What's the feeling amongst the farming community that you've been receiving? I mean, farmers in the dairy sector did really well last year, I believe, but now maybe the chickens are coming home to roost. What is the feeling on the ground as it relates to these milk and butter wars, the staples?
You know, it wouldn't be good, obviously. Like, we all know the costs of your average household has increased. It's no different for running a dairy or enterprise like the dairy farmers. It's electricity, feed, fertilizer, fuel, all them costing up, and the fuel's going back down slightly. But they took a double and a triple whammy over, as you say, they did quite well. But, you know, all them things that increased on top of it, you know, it's Tesco, Aldi, Lidl, I think, and Super Value have decided to pull the, just for your listeners who don't know, have decided to pull, I think it's 40 cent of the price of their own label butter and 10 cent of the litre of milk. And Tesco, nobody would come at bar Tesco yesterday, the day before. And Tesco said they're doing it to help their customers with their household staple cost. But most of their customers would be farmers' wives. And no farmer is massively rich. You know, I think farming, as I said, was always something that you were brought up in and that you progressed into. It's a way of life. Are they making massive amounts? No, they can't afford to take this loss. I think it was estimated, I read in the Farmer's Journal, that a dairy farmer could lose up to 50,000 a year and has done since January. And they can't afford to take that loss. You know, I don't know.
Is it the case, Emer, that there's a conflict going on here in that we can't really maybe necessarily do what we need to do in terms of, you know, climate commitments and also have cheap food? You know what I mean? Because I think there's a lot of people I'm asking, this is a separate question to some extent. There's some people that feel that the days of cheap food are over, because if we are to sort of make it in, you know, in new ways that are less impactful in the environment and what have you, that it can't be produced at the cost that people are used to.
Yeah, but it's the farmer that's taking the loss.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the...
No, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. In other words, that we expect cheap butter and milk at the shop, right? And we know it's the farmer getting the hit. But maybe we as consumers should not accept that. And then the farm, you know, we shouldn't that's expect right. that. And then the farmer gets his fair cut. Do you get where I'm coming from?
I really do believe that we need somebody in charge of this. And, you know, we have no agri-food regulator. The same thing happened with the beef not a year or so ago. They can basically, the retailers and the factories can basically do what they want in this country. And they're not held accountable in any way, shape or form. And our government and our minister would say they cannot get involved in that process. But, you know, somebody has to. There has to be an agri-food regulator put in place straight away. You know, there was all these discussions and tables and brought in last year when we had the problem in the beef prices. But, you know, what have we got out of it? You know, here we are today now sitting talking about what's going to happen with the dairy farmers. And it's not right. When is it going to stop? You know, when everybody's gone out of business. Like, I read yesterday in the Farmer's Journal, Jack Murphy wrote it. It was a great piece and people should probably go and read it. Basically, the government are talking about increasing and we need to increase our tillage farmers, right? But on the offside of that, the cereal growers have all gone out of business. Why are they going out of business? Cost, and also they can't get the land because all the dairy farmers have it rented. So we're hypocritical in what we're doing. And this is what needs to be looked at. You know, there's loads of very intelligent people in our country that should be brought in around these tables to make these decisions that will have a positive impact on farming throughout the country. And you can't just ignore all the small farmers, you know. I do think we need an agri-food regulator. I do think we need them straight away. Probably it will be too late for some of them. Them dairy farmers invested very heavily over the last few years in putting all these systems in place. They were told to increase and grow their businesses. And now, I think I watched Ear to the Ground one night, was a dairy farmer on. Now they've been told to bring it back again. No farmer knows where they're going at the minute. It's very hard to know what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And I would like to know, you spoke about there, the producers, Craig. What producers are we going to have in a few years if they can't have a sustainable business? Are we going to be importing everything that we eat? Why didn't we cut the cost, or why didn't Aldi and Lidl cut the cost of their pasta or something else? Why was it the Irish farmers? And they'll have that slogan across their shop window. We buy, and you know, Irish farmers. But that's, they're not supporting them when that is where they decide.
Oh, yeah, they'll give it, they'll have a leaflet out saying, meet the farmer. And they trade on the fact that they can show a picture of a local farmer. Liam, dairy farmers particularly and wherever else are you know, feel that they're having to absorb this price war, really, because the shops are trying to look after those that come in for the few bits, which is often butter and milk and what have you, and it's the farmer who is picking up the tab, it seems, Liam.
Yeah, well, the farmer is a price taker at the end of the day, and as Emma rightly said there, the factories and the retailers take whatever profit they can out of it and try and squeeze the farmer. And look, as Emma should well know at this stage, that Minister Jerry McConnell has taken in, has gone through the Dáil, processing the Dáil at the moment, a food regulator, an agri regulator, and what role that agri regulator is going to have, I'm not sure yet, but hopefully we'll be able to make a change as far as the prices the farmers receive. But I do believe, and some say it's anti-competitive, but I do believe that there has to be a minimum price set on agri-food that can't be, the farmer can get no lower a price than what has been set. So, as I said, some say it's anti-competitive. I don't know if it is or not, but I think for farmers to survive, especially smaller farmers, that's important, something like that happens. And the quicker this agri-regulator comes in to get started, to get set up and get started, I think the better, and I think it's positive news for the farmers.
Yeah, Pat, because there's us, the consumer, and then there is the farmer, and no one talks about all what goes on in between and all their profits and what have you. And they're insulated, you know.
I have mixed feelings on this. I mean, I'm from farming background. I want to note that farmers have never been backward in coming forward in organising themselves. I completely disagree with Emer, who said there are no such thing as rich farmers. There are. I mean, one of the really important things about agriculture is that there are two very clear groups, those that are huge, really farming on an industrial scale, and those that are part-time farmers. I get a bit impatient too as to the way the farming organisations manipulate the discourse. At times they want us to see that farming as an industry. At other times they want to see us to see it as a kind of a sacred cow, the farm family, you know. And they oscillate between these two positions depending on which, you know, works best. So, for example, like there was no end of discussion about how farming was, you know, it was basically generating, you know, it was a homegrown product that we were getting, all grass. Really, we had no environmental costs. And then when, you know, the price of goods, I mean, butter has increased enormously in the past year. And when that was kind of, you know, it wasn't initially, it was said it was transport costs were. And then it was clear it wasn't transport costs because the price of fuel was going down. And so it was fertilizer, but hello, there was no talk of the importance of fertilizer when they were talking about, you know, grass-fed cows and lack of environmental impact. So, I mean, I do think there is a question as to whether or not, what is the breakdown of money, who's making the profit, right, in terms of the retailers and the factory owners versus the farmers. I think that is, there's a fudge there. But, I mean, I wouldn't be looking to the Farmers' Journal for an unbiased opinion on this. Sorry, Eimear, you know.
Well, in fairness, it could maybe talk into the last conversation we had. Perhaps it's the only legitimate voice of farmers, because in every other newspaper, they're held up as being parasites, the worst thing ever.
Only legitimate. I compare them, for example, to the childcare sector. Farmers have had a representative in Europe since Adam was a boy. They have been extremely effective in organising, for example, co-ops, representation on co-ops. They have been vociferous in government. I mean, the whole idea of a Department of Agriculture, in a way, there's no Department of Childcare, you know. The childcare providers are seen as irrelevant, wiped out. So farmers are coming from the fishermen, another group that were sold on the river with the EU. Farmers have been doing very well. So we heard nothing when the
come here, Pat. I'll tell you what, I don't know how long, Pat, you've been holding on to this, but my word. Eimear, do you want a quick 30 seconds back?
Pat, I'm sorry. All I have to say is you are not involved in the farming sector. You are not in Donegal. And you certainly... If you were in Donegal, you would not say that the farmers are rich and doing well.
I said there was, in Meath, there's a very different story. I didn't say, I mean, small farmers, absolutely. But you said there are no rich farmers. Well, hello.
There might be some, but they're getting fewer and fewer. And you know something? You're talking about rich farmers. We need them farmers to produce what you want to eat. Your butter, your meat, your beef. And you said about the breakdown. I don't know about the breakdown of the butter, but I do know the breakdown of the beef. And the beef farmers are not getting, it's the factories that are making the money, and it's no different here with the butter.
Right.
The retailers are making the money. And I would be very, very firm on that.
All right. Liam?
Just very briefly, and I understand what Pat is saying there. And when you're down the south of the country, you see some of the large dairy farmers that's down there. And in fairness, the Farmers' Journal will say it. They will state it. Who is making the most money, the average income per year for dairy farmers, sheep farmers, all the farmers.
Yeah.
And you will see where some of the dairy farmers are doing fairly well. But there's huge, huge input costs as well. And nobody knows behind the scenes what the morals is like for them farmers. It looks good in the front, out front. But behind the scenes, nobody knows what the real story is. But as far as Eimear said, the farmers in Donegal, there's not very many rich farmers have been in Donegal.
All right.
I completely accept the location, Donegal. Yes, no rich farmers there, but there are rich farmers in the country.
Okay, well, what we'll do is we better take a break. We'll be back with a final segment with our brilliant guests after this break. Back in about 3 minutes. Okay, just a quick one, Eimear, interested in your view on this. Is the farmer's voice becoming more fractured? Is it, you know, because we are hearing of various different groups which are being formed, some with great attendance at certain events, and then, you know, maybe talk of rural parties that would be established to fight for rural issues, which I believe would probably be farming. Like, is the voice of the farmer in lobbying becoming fractured to the point where it's a disadvantage? What's the feeling?
Okay, well, if you take it from my own look on it, you know, a couple of years ago I might have been more actively involved in a lot of the different farm organizations and that were at the forefront of farming. I think people in general and farmers in general have become so busy and are struggling so much that we just don't have time to get involved with them. You know, so the parties and the farming, all the different organizations are still there. And I believe that they're doing their role to the best of their abilities. I did the rural group, which you spoke about. Do I see a need for it? Absolutely. I do believe that there should be. And I do understand why Michael Fitzmaurice has taken to do what he has done. When you have a particular party, regardless what that party is in government, you have to have an opposition party. And the reason you have to have an opposition party is for you have to listen to everybody's concerns and what their opinions are. And it's like any decision you make anywhere, you have to listen to everyone around the table because they might have a very good argument to put forward. And I feel that that's sometimes where we fall down. We go ahead, we implement new laws, we implement different, doesn't matter what it is, you know, for the people. And we're not really taking into account how it's going to affect them people. Mm. And that is why, and I see what he's doing and I understand what he's doing. And I suppose what he has been saying is he needs a voice. He can't do it all on his own.
Right. Liam, the more opposition parties there are, the better, because, you know, if you look at the polls, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, very, very strong still. You know what I mean? They're, if you, you the government parties as a collective, there's no reason really why you could make a very strong argument for them being able to be returned after the next election. So the more splintered, in inverted commas, the opposition is, the better it is for those government parties.
Well, as far as farming organisations are concerned, and everybody will be involved in this as well, myself way back here when the beef plan movement started. And, you know, that seemed to be a very good organisation that was, especially on the northwest and west coast and down the southwest. And some people try to take full control of it themselves, and it, it's happened on numerous cases, and the group splintered. And it's basically non-existent in this county now. Michael Fitzmaurice, as far as I remember, mooted this a number of years ago as well about starting up a new farming organisation. He didn't take it anywhere at that stage. Is he trying to give himself a bit of public support out there through the farming community before the next general election? I'm not so sure what the idea behind it is, but I do believe that there is enough farming organisations in the country as it stands. You're talking about opposition. There's plenty of opposition to each other. There's numerous amounts of farming organisations there. Unfortunately, some of them speak down the south of the country and different when they go up north. I was a member of an organisation myself, a farming organisation. I left, I'm a member of another one now. But when they're up here, they tell us what the small farmer want to hear. When they're down the south of the country, they tell them what the larger farmer want to hear. Mm-hmm. And that is wrong. I think if you're going to represent a particular type of fireman, that you should be representing that particular type of fireman, not trying to represent them all. Mm-hmm. And that's what someone's trying to do. I think maybe that's where they're falling down.
Pat, quick comment from you.
I agree with Liam on this. I think the voice of farmers, the whole farming area is fracturing. And the extent to which a new organisation, whether it will be dominated by, for example, mountainy sheep farmers who are really on subsistence and have no angle, as I see it, as opposed to the very well-heeled industrial-type farmers who are in very fertile land in the east. And the tendency would be, of course, that the dominant group would be those who have the time and the energy and the space to actually, as opposed to the people who are, an awful lot of farmers are part-time farmers, as Emer has implicitly said, that they're, you know, they themselves or their partners are working off the land. And so in a way, their voice is not going to be represented by those who have farm managers in situ and who are basically farming, you know, 4,000 acres of very fertile land. So I think there is an issue of the rural versus the urban. That is a real issue. But in a way, focusing it on farmers, I think paradoxically, it could actually weaken the farming voice because it will highlight the splits within farming.
I think the whole idea of it was not an organisation, it was a party per se, that Michael Fitzmaurice, just to work here on that.
Yeah, it's in fairness, it's me. I've kind of blended the two together and I've been sitting here watching it unfold in front of me and I apologise for that.
Yeah, it was a party and he wanted to put political representatives forward to represent, and it was rural farmers and the rural areas in which he did. But as regards to the farming organisations, we most definitely have enough farming
organisations. Emer McGuinness, manager of Donegal Mott, thank you. It's a pleasure as always, as it is Pat O'Connor, Professor Pat O'Connor. Brilliant to have you back on the show. Hope to see you again really, really soon. And last but not least, Cathaoirleach, Liam Blaney, thank you, by the way, for coming on as well. It's much appreciated. And have a lovely weekend, Liam. Good to see you. All right.